Hi, this is Bernie Wides, broadcasting on the Heritage Radio Network from beautiful downtown Bushwick. And we're broadcasting from Roberta's Terrific Restaurant that was reviewed in the New York Times. So Roberta's is getting some good publicity also. And today I have a special guest, a friend of mine, a colleague from the Museum of Natural History, and his name is Mike Hamburg. And Mike is an astronomer, and that's going to be our topic today, astronomy. We're going to range all over the universe, and who knows where we'll end up. So I want to introduce Mike, and I'm going to ask Mike to tell us how he got interested in astronomy.
Thanks, Bernie. Like any normal boy, back in the 50s, space was a very big topic, and I was smitten by the space bug, anything that had to do with planets, aliens, rocket ships, I was for it. And then, of course, adolescence happens and you forget all about those things. And when I was an adult and in the country...
You get interested in different kind of
heavenly bodies. Yes, right, we do. That's a topic for another show. Okay. So I then, as an adult, was spending more time in the country. And I noticed that, my God, look how dark the sky is here. And it just rekindled my interest in space. And I got myself a telescope. And I just started observing. And I really found a passion for myself. And now I can't begin to believe that I would have a life without looking up.
Yes. And what about the museum, Michael? How'd you get interested in the Museum of Natural History?
Well, it's funny, Bernie. When I was a child, that was the only place. I was living in the Bronx, and that was the only place I was allowed to go on the subway was to the Museum of Natural History. Every Saturday, a buddy of mine and I would get on the train, and we would go to the museum and spend Saturday and then go back to the Bronx. So that was a kind of pilgrimage that never went away, and it was just a great honor to be able to get a job there as a docent.
Right. I have a similar story. I used to take the subway from way out in Brooklyn all the way to the museum.
You Brooklyn people.
And spend the day there. It was terrific. It was free in those days, and the subway was a nickel, I think, or a dime, so it was a terrific bargain. So we'll start talking about astronomy now, and we're going to start at the beginning, or what we think is the beginning, called the Big Bang. So a lot of people have all kinds of things in their mind when they hear about the Big Bang. So I'm going to ask Michael, maybe he can give us a little short introduction to it.
Okay, Bernie, I'd be more than happy to. First of all, like we were talking a little bit before we went on the air, the Big Bang refers to the birth of the universe, and it is actually a not-so-nice nickname that a competitor gave to the Big Bang, and it stuck. So we're talking about the ultimate origin. Where did our universe come from? When did this happen? And the clue came when Edwin Hubble and his associates noticed that there seemed to be a tremendous rush away from the Earth. Everything they looked at, all the galaxies, all the matter in the universe seemed to be moving further and further apart. That means that if you go back in time, that things were probably closer together. So if you imagine the universe as a film and you run it backwards, at some point, everything must have been in one place. The scientists call this a singularity, and we don't really understand what that is. We give it a name. We don't know if that had always existed. And at some point, that singularity exploded and created everything that we see today, matter, energy, and time and space.
So how long ago? Do we have any idea, Michael, the approximation of age of the universe?
We actually do. We can actually measure the expansion rate and run the numbers backward, and we come up with a neat little number of 13.7 billion years, give or take a few million, of course.
Oh, okay, because it's kind of a vague thing. 13.7 billion.
Well, Bernie, the biggest holy grail for a long time was to nail down the speed of recession, so-called the Hubble constant. How fast is the universe expanding?
Okay, now you mentioned Hubble twice. Just tell us something about Hubble, because most people have heard about the Hubble telescope.
Yes.
So is that the same Hubble, same guy?
Yes. Hubble was an astronomer of the early 20th century, and much to my surprise, he wasn't a nice man, but he was a brilliant person, and he was very exacting in his science. And he got use of the then largest optical telescope, the 100-inch telescope in Mount Wilson, the Hooker telescope. And he and his colleagues were looking deep, deep into space and actually gave us a new dimension for our universe, at much, much bigger than was previously thought. And as a corollary, he saw that everything was moving away.
Away from us.
Away from us.
So that's the famous Hubble telescope.
Hubble, named after Hubble.
That's
Edwin
still,
Hubble.
Still up there working, and they sent a repair crew up.
Yes, they did.
And
now it is it is better than the telescope that was originally designed and has taught us more about the universe than every other instrument that preceded it.
Okay, so it was really one of the great inventions
of development. One of the greatest instruments ever developed.
Terrific. Yeah. So, you know, how big is the universe? Can we tell how big it is?
That's a great question, Bernie. And yeah. I think we have to modify the question a little bit by saying that we need to call it the observable universe.
Okay, why is that?
Well, that's because, again, there's a little funny law in physics says that light travels at a finite speed. There is a speed limit to light, which, if anybody is really interested, is about 300,000 kilometers a second. Mm. So a particle of light could go around the Earth 7.5 times in 1 second. Pretty fast, right?
Yeah, that's pretty fast.
But it is not fast enough to see the very beginnings of the Big Bang. So we can only see out a certain distance, and that is how much time the light signals have come back to us. And that is called the observable universe, and it is about 13 billion light years.
Light years. So there's something that we have to talk about also, because you said that light has this tremendous speed.
Yes.
Around the Earth, what?
Seven and a half times in 1 second.
In 1 second. Right. That gives us people an idea of how fast light really moves. But if you could talk about, you know, I know that we can't use ordinary distances like light years seem to be a crucial measurement in astronomy.
Absolutely. Now, one of the nice things to do is to keep a scale in mind. If we look at the moon, it looks like, you know, we can see that instantaneously, but the light has actually taken about 1.5 seconds to travel from the moon to our eyes. If we look at the sun, and please only do that with correct filters, that light takes a little more than 8 minutes to get to us. If we look at the planet Mars, that light is taking about 10 minutes to get to us. So light takes time to travel even way out towards the edge of the universe. Some of the objects that we see, that light has been traveling for billions and billions of years. So the further out you look into space, the further back in time you're actually looking.
Yeah, so that's really a tough concept to put your head to about light years.
Yeah.
Well, so if it's less than a light year, do you call it a light minute?
Second? You can say that. Absolutely.
Can we use that terminology?
Absolutely. We can say that the sun is about 8 light minutes away from the Earth. That is true. And light years are equivalent in miles to about 6 trillion miles each light year.
Each light year.
Yeah, and remember, it is a measure of distance. It is the distance that light travels in 1 year.
Okay, so it's not really time, it's distance.
It is distance.
Okay, that's another thing to try to keep in your head.
You have to repeat these things several hundred times before they start making sense, I know.
Before it makes sense.
Right.
So this is a good place to take a little pause.
Okay.
Talking about light years, because we're coming over the internet, and all that stuff travels at the speed of light.
Yes, it
too.
Does.
Radio waves and all the other waves do it. So we're going to stop for a minute, and remember our sponsor today is TechServe, and this is the Radio Network, and we'll be back in a short while. See you in a minute. Okay, here we are back on the Heritage Radio Network. The program is The Naturalist. That's me, Bernie Wides, and my special guest today, Mike Hamburg, who, as you can see or listen to, is really an astronomy enthusiast and spends as much time as he can pursuing this interest. I wouldn't say it's a hobby. It's 'cause it's really science. So there's a lot to learn and a lot of information to find out. So one of the things I'm going to ask Michael is you know, how do astronomers go about making discoveries and all that? Do they spend a lot of time at the telescopes? Do they use other instruments? Or if you can fill us in Mike, on that.
It's a great question, Bernie, because most of us are ignorant about how scientists do their discoveries. And it's interesting. Just a little history. By the end of the 19th century, astronomy was a dead science because all they could do with their telescopes, and they had some pretty nice telescopes, was make the positions of the objects they were seeing. They didn't understand any of the processes that were going on. And unlike other sciences, you can't go out and grab a sample and bring it back to the lab and dissect it, although it's becoming more possible now. So by a very, very fortuitous accident, a great discovery was made in a German laboratory that light held the secret to the universe. And by that, I mean all the ingredients that make up our universe have a particular chemical characteristic. We call it a chemical signature. They give off frequencies that are unique to them. And so the great science of spectroscopy was born around the turn of the last century, and the whole story of the universe opened up. There's much they can discover by analyzing the light of stars and galaxies.
So it's all about the light. Yes. We can't get away from light, because I think, as I remember, the bigger the telescope, you say a 100-inch telescope, so if you have a 200-inch telescope, you can collect more light.
Right,
and
exactly.
And spectrometry is breaking down the light and analyzing the light.
Yes, it is. It was actually something that was discovered by Isaac Newton, who's also known for his work with gravity, but he was the first one to analyze the very nature of light.
Okay, like if you take a prism,
exactly,
you can break the light up into its various colors, and those colors equal?
They equal the rainbow. Everybody has seen the rainbow, and this is the basic Roy G. Biv colors, red, green, blue, violet, and so on. And what happens is that in the 20th century, beginning with radio waves, we found that this electromagnetic spectrum is much wider than our visible light, and we can get information through radio waves, through microwaves. Everybody probably has a microwave oven. Well, the universe has objects that give off microwaves and infrared and ultraviolet and gamma rays and X-rays. These are telling us a lot about what's going on out there.
So these are all different forms of light
energy.
Yes,
they are.
And it's just different wavelengths of light?
Different wavelengths, which just really means a different energy level. And that tells us what kind of object is out there. What are we looking at? It tells us its temperature, its chemical composition. It can also tell us how far away it is, because we do know the speed of light. It also can tell us whether something is approaching us or receding from us.
Okay, so if we let's take an example. If we look at, well, it has to be something that's emitting light.
Sure.
So it wouldn't work with the moon, because the moon is just reflecting light. So let's say that we train our spectroscope light on the sun.
Yes.
Okay. So what can we learn about the sun from the light of the sun? I mean, first of all, you never look at it with your bare eyes.
Never.
Because it's too powerful and it will burn your retinas. But if we use the instruments and we use a spectrograph aimed at the sun, what will it tell us about the sun?
Well, it can tell us a lot. First of all, it can tell us the temperature, because temperature is really an indication of an energy level, and we measure the motion of atoms that way. That's what heat is. So we know that. Then we can look at the light in its various components and tell what kind of elements. In fact, Bernie, the element helium, and if you think of the origin of the word helium, from the Greek Helios was first discovered on the sun, not on the earth. Mm-hmm. So we can tell that we have helium, we have oxygen, we have carbon, we have all types of compounds and elements on that star, the sun.
On the sun.
Yes.
Okay. I think we should reemphasize, Mike, what you just said, that the sun is a star.
It is a star.
Okay, so what's, so just for the folks mm-hmm. that are listening in, the difference between a star and some of the other bodies, like a planet or like the moon?
Good question. Well, a star is the only object in the universe that creates its own energy. And it does so by a very, very clever process called thermonuclear fusion. Inside the star, light elements like hydrogen and helium are compressed under tremendous pressures and temperatures and forced to fuse together. And in doing that, in becoming a new element, they give off heat and light. And this was actually a discovery of the early 20th century. Before that, nobody knew why stars twinkled or shined like that.
Okay.
So, and planets are much smaller bodies that do not do this. We see planets by their reflected sunlight.
Okay, so if we look at the night sky in New York City, maybe occasionally when it's clear enough and there's not too much other junk in the sky, and we see, like this month, we can see the planet Jupiter mm-hmm. is pretty close to the Earth, comparatively speaking. And Jupiter looks, it's shining, but it's not twinkling like a star would.
Right.
So the light that's coming to the Earth from Jupiter is coming from?
The sun. It is being reflected off the cloud tops of Jupiter. And you can actually, for our listeners who are interested, if it is clear tonight, and I hope it would be, towards the western sky after sunset, you can see a very bright star, and that is the planet Jupiter. Later on, a few hours later, in the eastern sky, you'll see a reddish star rising, and that is the planet Mars, which is coming into prominence today.
What does prominence mean, Mike? Tell us.
Well, you know, because the Earth goes around the sun and the planets go around the sun and there's this great celestial dance, we don't see the same thing every night. And the planets, because they're close to us, we see the greatest movement. So planets are have appointments with visibility. And
okay.
Tonight, Jupiter and Mars are in the sky.
Okay, so if you're really interested in this, how would people find out, Michael, you know, what night to look for what in
there,
the sky?
You can go on various websites. One of the ones I would do would be astronomy.com or skyandtelescope.com. These are two very good magazines that have interactive features that give you sky maps for any time you specify.
Okay, and sometimes I've noticed even in the Times, you can get the phases of the moon, at least.
Yes, every
in the Times.
On the weather page.
On the weather page, right. Yeah. And that has a lot to do with also with the tides on the Earth. But we won't talk about those today. We're going to save that for when we do a whole program on the Earth and the tides and the gravitational pull and all that kind of stuff. Today we're going to stay a little further out in the heavens.
Sounds good.
And hopefully the sky will clear tonight. Right now I'm looking at the sky and it's a little bit cloudy, but who knows what's going to happen tonight.
Who knows?
Right. Before we go any further, I want to mention that Michael has a book that he did a few years ago, and I wonder if it's still around. It's called Astronomy Made Simple, basic book by Michael Hamburg. And who was the publisher, Mike?
It was published by Doubleday.
By Doubleday. So you might be able to find it in a bookstore. And it was a basic book, and I think you would enjoy it as a sort of a primer to get you off on the right track to astronomy. So we're going to take a short break again. And remember that our sponsor is TechServe, which is a terrific organization. They service Apple products. They sell Apple products. They're on 23rd Street. And this is the Heritage Radio Network, The Naturalist, with my guest Michael Hamburg today. And we'll be back shortly. Okay, here we are back on the air, and we're back from the heavens. We've been wandering around the heavens and checking out different things, and we're down to earth here in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And I don't think you can get much more down to earth than in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And just before we continue, I want to give you a phone number in case you have any questions that have come up during this show or any of the shows. I'll give you a phone number to call up, which is the Heritage Radio Network. It's 718-497-2128. And in New Jersey, it's Bigelow. No, that's when they used to do the fundraisers. So it's 718-497-2128, the phone number. And if you want to send in a question over the internet, you can do that at info@heritageradionetwork.com. Okay, so if you think of a question even tomorrow or the next day or whenever, just send those in. And if I can't find the answer, well, I now have my terrific reference. I have Michael, who's not too far away in the firmament here. He lives in Brooklyn, actually, so we can...
Heaven on earth.
We can get together again. Right. So we're going to continue now with some of the topics. And the first thing I wanted to ask Michael was do astronomers, how do they make discoveries? I know you mentioned the spectrograph, which is a very important instrument, and a telescope. Now, are there any other ways that astronomers work?
Yes, there are, Bernie. What's wonderful is we're making tremendous advances in technology right now. So we are no longer just bound by Earth-based observatories. We have all types of telescopes and other detectors in space right now above the Earth's atmosphere. And that's important because the atmosphere of the Earth actually absorbs a lot of those different frequencies that we talked about before. And we are blind by, you know, X-rays and gamma rays, which is actually good for us because they're not very healthy. So our atmosphere protects us, but it blocks off the information that is carried by those frequencies. So now we have, of course, we talked about the Hubble, and there was another mission that was sent up called the Spitzer Infrared Telescope, which is able to find stars before they become visible by detecting their heat. Mm-hmm. Infrared light is basically heat. We also had X-ray telescope. The Chandra X-ray telescope was able to give us a lot of information about black holes, which I know everybody is interested in.
Yeah, I think we'll save those for another program because that could take us quite a while.
Yes,
because I still get confused with some of that black hole.
Welcome
stuff
to the crew.
Yes. Right. It's really a black hole of information also.
It
so
we also have we also been able to land things on other planets.
Oh, right. That's right. Good exploring.
Yes. Yeah. So beginning, in the early 70s, where we started to put down little robots on the moon, and the Soviet Union at that time was concentrating on Venus, we've looked at Mars, the planet Mars, which is most like the Earth of all the planets in the solar system. And we have had a number of landers on there. In fact, the two little rovers that are there now were designed to last for 3 months, and they're going into their sixth year, and they are pretty much both operational, although I do have to say one of them has gotten stuck in the sand.
Yes, I advised NASA a long time ago to take out insurance with AAA.
Exactly.
Because now this thing is stuck in the mud. This thing, which cost, I don't know how many millions, but it's stuck in the mud.
They've earned their money, believe me. They've earned their cost.
After all this time, those little guys have been working all this time. And I remember that they said that they would only work for a couple of months.
That's right.
Because the dust on Mars would cover up the solar collectors, and they wouldn't be able to power themselves.
And just by serendipity, enough Martian wind cleans off those solar panels and the energy levels go off. This was not planned on, by the way.
Right. It just happened because we have a model in the Museum of Natural History in the planetarium of one of the rovers. It's an actual perfect model, except we don't have all the instruments in it. It's the model rover itself. And I used to show people on the solar collectors just the dust from the museum, from New York City schmutz or dust. Schmutz is a scientific word.
It is.
It means dirt. So just from the schmutz in the air in New York, our solar collectors. And I said, that's what's going to happen to the rovers. The solar collectors will be covered with this film of red, red stuff from the surface of Mars, and they'll stop working.
One of the greatest discoveries that the rovers have made is it confirmed that there was water on Mars, and plenty of it, in the past. And this has implications for our question about life in the universe, but probably we'll talk about that later on.
Right. Okay, so what about some of the latest discoveries, Michael? I know that we have discovered extrasolar planets.
Yes.
Can you explain that to us?
Absolutely.
Folks?
Well, extrasolar simply means that these are planets going around stars other than the sun. All right. Our solar system is ours. Extra is somebody else's star. In fact, we've cataloged more than 400 planets going around other stars. But before we get, you know, pack our bags and rush to get some real estate, these are not very hospitable places. Most of the planets that we've discovered resemble a hot Jupiter orbiting very close to its parent star, and actually has given us a whole new perspective on how solar systems form. The reason is that our instruments were not good enough to resolve small planets, small rocky planets like the Earth. But there is a mission up there right now called the Kepler mission, which was launched last March. And its job over the next 3 years is to study 1,000 stars in a small patch of sky. If you held your arm outstretched and put a dime in your finger, that's the actual area of space that it's studying. And this instrument is capable of finding worlds as small as the Earth, which is a big step. And after that, if we find rocky planets, that's the next big step. And of course, the grand step would be to find a planet that would be supporting some type of life.
Right. So the story of science is bigger and better instruments, and it increases our range of visibility and our ability to see further, collect more light, and conduct more science.
Right. We're also packing more electronics into smaller packages, and therefore they are easier to launch. It is very expensive to launch objects into space, in the millions of dollars for every pound. So, you know, part of the trouble with science is that it is always going begging for money.
That's true. And with times like this, when we have such a lousy economy, hopefully they'll still devote money for science research and at least keep the scientists employed.
Let's hope so.
And all that stuff. And science teachers.
Okay. Definitely.
You didn't mention that once you taught.
Yes.
And didn't you teach some science?
I taught astronomy actually in high school here in the city for about 10 years. And it was great because I actually had a lot of students from the very area that we're broadcasting from. And, you know, most of these kids never looked up, and it was probably dangerous to do so. So we got a nice appreciation about the sky and what's in it. There are two other, if I may, there are two other important areas of discovery now. One is, and they're both unanswered questions, what is dark matter and what is dark energy? And the reason they're called that is we don't know what they are.
Right. And just that matter of dark energy and dark matter is a hot topic now.
Hot topic.
Because, as Michael said, we don't really know what it is, but we don't think that space is as empty as they call it space, that there's something there, but we really don't know. Mike, can you tell us a little bit more about the kind of research they're doing?
Sure. Well, you know, again, you've alluded to space and emptiness. And for most of the history of science, when people thought about space, they thought about the vacuum. There was nothing out there. And evidence now has proven that space is filled with some things that we don't understand. And dark matter, as opposed to regular matter, is matter that doesn't give off any signals or reflect any light. The only way we know it's there is by the gravity that it creates. And this was discovered by measuring the speed of how galaxies spin around their axes. And in order to do that at the speeds they were measured, there had to be a lot of more stuff out there. And most of that couldn't be seen. So science has concluded that there is some type of invisible matter out there.
Okay, that's good. We touched on invisible matter. We didn't talk anything about energy. So what? But we're running out of time, and time is always a thing when you're talking
time
about astronomy.
Is relative, right?
Time is relative, and some of my relatives I don't spend any time with.
Same here.
So, and Michael, it's the same thing. So we're going to sign off now. And remember, if you have a question, anything we spoke about today or any of the Naturalist programs, 718-497-2128 or online, info@heritageradionetwork.com. And our sponsor today was TechServe. And I want to thank my guest, Michael Hamburg, for being with me today.
My pleasure.
And hopefully we'll do it again. So we'll sign off right now.